Hello and welcome to House of Commons podcast. My name's Nick Dennis and I'm a conservative activist and blogger. This week I'm joined by Nick Tyrone, who is an author of an upcoming book on the Coalition the AV referendum, plus blogs on his website nicktyrone.com about transformation in politics and what's going to happen in the future in politics. Hi Nick.
Hello.
And I'm also joined by Carl Packman, who's a Labour writer who blogs regularly, basically almost everywhere and anywhere. And he's written a book on the rise of payday lending and has campaigned against legal loan sharks, as they're called. Hi, Carl.
Hello.
Good. Well, thank you for both joining me on this beautiful day when I'm looking out my window and it's still sunny. So I really appreciate the fact that you're inside on a computer with a headset talking to me. Okay, well, first of all, I wanted to start with a general question about politics, because obviously next week we've got the EU elections, and also we've got the local elections in some areas. So is there any point in actually voting in these elections? Nick, what do you think?
Well, yes, I do. I think voting is extremely important. I think that I think it's easy to do it down, and I think it's easy to sort of take a reactionary approach, as well, we can go through the some very famous people who have done so fairly recently. But I think that I think the only way that you can register your voice and what you want is through voting. Having said all that, I mean, I started with the positive. I'll sort of close this statement with the negative, and just say I think if you look at the two elections coming up, the EP elections and the local elections, I think people feel they feel a bit cut off from Europe. They particularly feel cut off from the EP Parliament and what it does and what their MEP specifically does. And I think that within local government, I think people feel like, well, the country's so centralized anyhow, what difference does the local government, the makeup of the local government make anyway? So I'd say that's probably the negative, but I'd say the positive wins out over the negative.
Carl, what do you think?
Yeah, I guess it's very very trendy, I suppose, to assume that voting doesn't change anything. And I'm thinking of the infamous quote, I think it was Emma, it was an anarchist writer, if I remember from Russia, who Emma Goldman, who said if voting changed anything, they would outlaw it. And I just think that that is situated in a particular moment in history. And I know over the years, people have been very frustrated with the merging of the centre with Labour and the Conservatives often looking very similar in style. But I just don't think that's the case anymore. I think that there's a real ideological drive, and I think it's been shifted by the importance over the last few years of the fringe parties, and one of those parties is obviously the United Kingdom Independence Party. I think that the one thing you can say that they have introduced into politics is that they are able to drive the centre ground, perhaps more right wing, and I think that introduction has given the notion of voting that much more importance. We can't sit on the sidelines anymore, because sitting on the sidelines is itself a political action, and I really think that in order to change anything, we've got to make the right decision rather than no decision. So I think that this stage voting is of utmost importance.
One of the things I'll always remember about anarchism is it's the one political ideology that actually hasn't done anything particularly. So all other political ideologies have had governments of some form and power of some form anywhere. All I think the best that anarchists can have is maybe Barcelona during the Spanish Civil War. So so while anarchism might be a beautiful idea in some ways, it's never been very good at actually maintaining power. But
I think so. It would also, to me, I think that it's something that has never really been able to capture, ideologically, obviously, it doesn't want to, but it's never been able to capture that one utmost important way of changing something, and that is through voting. And that makes me sound like a fuddy-duddy political centrist, but I am a great believer in democracy, and that is that because I think it's a vehicle for change.
I mean, how dare you think that you're just a fuddy-duddy political centrist because you believe in democracy? I mean, what sort of society are you living now? Sorry, Nick, you were just going to come in there, were you?
Oh, no, I was just going to say about anarchy. I mean, it's interesting. I was sort of drawn to, well, sort of, you know, I was sort of drawn to anarcho-syndicalism in my youth. When I say my youth, I mean 15, 16 sort of thing. I actually have a bit in the book about that, and sort of how I think that sort of to be... I don't know, to be an anarchist beyond the age of about 19 is, I think, actually a bit embarrassing, because what you realize, of course, is that it never works, because the idea of anarchy is essentially, look at these government, these people in government telling us what to do, oh, they're all privileged, they all hoard it for themselves, let's get rid of them, and that somehow what that will then do is that everything will be great, and everyone will get along with each other, and, you know, it's sort of this very childish idea that you don't need rules, which I think, as you grow up, you realize is not the case.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, I feel the same about libertarianism, obviously, because in the conservative movement, we have, you know, I mean, liberalism is, I really like liberalism, and a dose of libertarianism makes conservatism so much better. But when you start speaking to the real true believers in libertarianism, it just doesn't seem logical. Their ideas don't work with how humans really want to interact, because humans do like order and understanding how things work. And one of the great things about what's happening to UKIP at the moment is about 2 or 3 years ago, we had a lot of young conservatives leave us who were libertarians, saying they were going off because we weren't a proper libertarian party and they were going off to join UKIP. And now seeing UKIP go into a completely sort of statist and reactionary party, and watching all these libertarian young ex-Tories trying to justify their existence still being UKIP members is brilliant, because what they're doing is they're using the same ideas that they same words they criticise us for, which is basically in parties you get different points of view and all this type of stuff. But talking of simple crazy ideas, I mean, Russell Brand obviously sort of started this by writing an article saying that voting didn't matter. But the problem with his article, I think, it was driven mainly by ego, because, you know, I am one of 60 million people in the UK. My vote is important, but it shouldn't have any more importance than the amount of, you know, one in 60 million. So the idea that, you know, voting isn't important because voting, you know, doesn't give me complete power really doesn't really take into account what a democratic society is all about, which is all of us joining together and trying to sort of get the flow of where we're moving towards.
Yeah. I mean, I think what's interesting about the Brand thing is in a weird sort of way, I don't want to overstate this because you could go down the wrong road with this, but what Brand did, it reminded me a little bit of a sort of Lord Byron sort of thing. You know, a sort of this 19th century sort of thing where a lot of the artistic community sort of felt like, well, look, democracy doesn't work, does it? It's all a bit bourgeois and a bit lame. And obviously, there was something about fascism, which hadn't really been explored. You know, we're all sort of, fascism's become a dirty word, right? So, by the way, because of what happened in the 20th century. But you only have to look back to the 19th century, where it was in its sort of nascent stage, and people. People like Byron were drawn to the idea of, well, you know, why it's great, you know, it's all the jackboots and the, you know, the sort of the artistic sort of kind of angle of it, if you like, the sort of perverse artistic angle of it. And so it reminded me a bit of that, actually, sort of Brand sort of coming out and saying, oh, it's all a bit lame and who cares? And actually, that's an easier thing to sell, I think. It's a very populist thing. It's an easier thing to sell to people who are largely, you know, feel disenfranchised, whether rightly or wrongly, than saying, actually, guys, if you just stood up a bit and thought about it, you could probably make a difference. That's a much harder message to sell.
Yeah, and
it was ego. That's very interesting, because for me, I think that the Brand, what happened there was that it was about hedonism as well. For me, what he said reminds me very much of some of the excitement that was notable during the Occupy days in the UK, in the US and other places. But at the time, I recall looking at an article by a very old Marxist called Paul Mattick, who talked about the hedonistic days of left-wing leaderless meetings that he went to in Germany in the early 20th century, and said that it was great, all the energy going around, the enthusiasm, for social change and the mass meetings, I think he recalls, and the demonstrations and the street fights, all very heated. But later on in his life, he looks back and he recalls those hedonistic days, and he says it was mere whistling in the dark. That's how he calls it. And he was just, the suggestion is that at the time it seems very exciting, it seems like we're doing something for the good, but actually nothing has resulted because it's directionless. It might be one thing to be leaderless, but it ends up being directionless. And I think that that's a lesson, unfortunately. You know, my 18 year old self would hate me for saying this now, but unfortunately it's probably the case that whistling in the dark meant nothing. Maybe it was better to try and fit a tune around it, if I'm going to be careful.
Well, please don't sing, though, Carl. Use a metaphor, but don't sing. Now we're sort of coming on to, basically the difficulty of selling the message that actually life is difficult and it involves compromises and it involves those things that aren't as simplistic as writing a thought piece saying, isn't it rubbish that we can't do what we want to do? And, you know, you've got the rise of UKIP, who are selling a very, very simple message, which is an unrealistic message in my view, that essentially the world will be, or Britain will be improved if we got control of our borders back. Mm. So how do we counteract that message but still actually be honest about what the truth is?
I mean, I think one of the things that's interesting about the UKIP thing, you were just coming back to what you were saying about the libertarians all going to UKIP and then flooding back and that sort of thing. I think partly because I think libertarianism and, for instance, nationalism is just, they're completely incompatible, if you think about it. The libertarian, for instance, the libertarian viewpoint is, well, why shouldn't I hire Romanians and Bulgarians if they want to come to this country? Everybody, they win, I win, what's wrong with that? Whereas obviously from a nationalist point of view, which is really their bread and butter, that gets cancelled out. And when you've seen libertarianism come against nationalism with them, they've always had to opt for nationalism because that's in essence what they're about.
Well, it's because nationalists have the boots, don't they? And they can kick the liberals who have nice ideas. I mean, the ultimate liberalism argument now for being in UKIP is we're not against immigration. We just want control of our borders. But of course, we'll let lots of people in. Well, it's funny to see how they, then on the other side, you've got the other UKIP people who are basically, this isn't about controlling our borders, it's about stopping anyone getting in. And when Farage talked about Syrian refugees, it was really interesting because that really actually opened up a real split within UKIP, because when he talked about, well, we should let in some Syrian refugees, there were certain members of his party who went crazy about that, saying we shouldn't at all, and he had to adapt his position. So we only let in Christian Syrian refugees, as some way saying that's more acceptable.
That seems to be because over time UKIP has had to, not had to, but it has become a party, or at least aimed to be a party for all people, especially all people trying to capture what is a big tent party, i.e. people from the Conservative Party. And in order to try and capture that people from that big tent, they've had to be, to some people, the Libertarian Party, to other people, the dog whistling jingoistic nationalist party. It's been very tricky for them. But what I found very interesting of late, especially with the some of the high profile resignations from UKIP, is the idea that they didn't know that UKIP were once slightly racist or slightly dodgy on that front. Or at least, okay, so let me qualify that. If they're not racist, they are at least pandering to the racist vote. I remember recently Neil Hamilton saying quite cheerfully that he was taking on the decent vote from the BNP, which no one should proud about whatsoever. I mean, 10 years ago, there was a chap called Frank Maloney who said that he wouldn't go campaigning. He was a UKIP council candidate, if I remember rightly, at the time. He said he wouldn't go to the borough of Camden because there are too many gays there. And his campaign manager at the time was another chap called Gary Cartwright, who used to be a National Democrats candidate, which I think was an offshoot of the English Democrats. Right. And prior to joining UKIP, was a contributor to David Irving's historical revisionist focal point website. So the notion that this is a great surprise that UKIP apart from the very high profile people like Nigel Farage, look for or scout, you know, quite odd racists or homophobes or people that you wouldn't want around to your dinner party. The idea is astonishing. They've been for 10 years this rabid rainbow coalition of odd people and racists.
It's basically like, it's like Phobes Are Us. You got a phobe, we've got a home for you.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
I think it's the angry vote, isn't it? It's people who are just annoyed. I mean, I was surprised that at Labour conference last year, I put together something with the Fabians about what should the Labour position be on an in-out referendum. And, you know, purposely stacked the deck so that it was quite controversial. You know, had sort of Eurosceptic Labour people, and then, you know, people like Mike Gapes, who were obviously very pro-Europe. But what was amazing was there was this group of young guys who were, you know, they were quite young, I mean, 18, 19. And they were all saying, you know, we're socialists, and, you know, the thing about Labour is that they're not, you know, they're not the true socialist party anymore. And then, but on the flip side, saying, oh, actually, we hate Europe, and we're going to vote UKIP. You just think, you know, and Mike Gapes rightly sort of called them on it. It's like, how is it that you want the UK to be more socialist, but you want to vote for a party that's essentially, you know, saying we want a flat tax and we want to basically eliminate all, you know, departments of government other than, you know, maybe the Home Office and the Department, the MOD. And it's these sort of contradictions I think you have to push on. I think people have to push on. I really enjoyed the Farage being called on his German wife. Hearing foreign voices or whatever he said, you know, there's all these foreign accents, these foreign languages, you know, this idea that, well, look, you German is spoken in your house. Are you really this xenophobic in real life? Or is it actually just a con, Nigel? And I think he was sort of slightly exposed to some degree for being sort of in a perverse sort of way, another politician, in other words. You know, he said what he needed to get that vote.
Nick, at night, do you imagine that Nigel Farage goes home and weeps?
You mean, what have I done with my life? That's
the thing. Well, that's an interesting point, though, because, I mean, one of the things that amused me about UKIP a few months ago was when they were getting asked all those difficult questions about you support the flat tax and all this sort of stuff. They just made, well, Farage made the decision, probably live on air without telling anyone, to scrap all their policies. so now they don't have any. It's basically the best way to actually get all the angry people to join you. You say, we don't have any policies. Our only policy is if you're angry, come and join us.
None of the above party.
Yeah, none of the above, and also none of those over there as well.
I mean, I think that's why it's been interesting what UKIP's done in this election campaign, because at what point do they become just a slightly more PC version of the BNP? You know, I mean, seriously, it's like, okay, well, we're basically the BNP. We're not overtly racist. We're not going to say anything about black people, but it's pretty much the same thing.
That's the biggest. That's the biggest insult you could ever give UKIP, saying you're the slightly more PC version of the BNP, because obviously they hate PC. So.
Exactly.
Well, so on top of that, they're politically correct insofar as they offend their own people. As Nick Cohen wrote in his Observer piece today, all you've got to do is have a good argument against UKIP.
Yeah.
They will shout down, you know, going back on every notion of libertarianism ever, will try and shut you down.
Yeah.
So their version of political correctness extends only to their members, which,
yeah,
I don't know if that's not, that's that, at best, that is the sort of weirdness that you get in a small town, you know, gun-toting American village where we won't accept anyone else here because we don't trust outsiders. That's what they are. UKIP is a small, weird, gun-toting, scared, weird mash of people who shouldn't be trusted in society, really. I'm trying to be as logical as possible without naming anyone, basically.
Yeah. I mean, I think that Farage had sort of, I think Farage has sort of destroyed his mission in a way, because, I mean, whatever happens to UKIP from now on, he's slightly gone, he decided to take the easy road, I think, which was let's bash that anti-immigration. Let's just go down that road. Let's do the anti-immigrant thing. When actually he could have tried to do the opposite, which is much harder, but would have possibly paid off for his ultimate goal, which is, I assume, he wants the UK to be out of the European Union. If that's his goal, surely he needed to make Euroscepticism more mainstream. I just feel like he's failed in that.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, I imagine he does his tours and he goes around to speak to different places. And every place he goes to, I imagine he asks the person before he steps on stage, okay, who do we hate here then? I know over the border they hate HS2 and Polish immigrants. What is it here? Oh, yes, it's the third runway of Heathrow and Punjabi speakers. Okay, I've got that. So I'll write that on my hand.
In that, he should have from the outset engaged in what was a positive call for libertarianism. So yeah. I mean, at least up until a few years ago, Nigel Farage was able to say that his party was an anti-racist, libertarian, skeptic party.
Yeah.
And once upon a time, especially when it was under the rule of Professor Alan Sked, I think his name is, the founder of UKIP.
Yeah.
It could have, it quite rightly probably was something like that, along those lines. And, I mean, Nigel Farage makes a good point in a way. Many, many parties do have nutters in their parties. But the point is, A, you should be dealing with your ones. And don't just throw away comments like, well, other parties do it, and why can't we?
Yeah.
Well, there is something to that. There is something to the idea that Nigel Farage, he could have done a positive... You know, just purely for ideas, for the battle of ideas in the UK, it'd be great to have a truly libertarian party.
But I mean, I think a very key moment for them was gay marriage, because when David Cameron sort of announced that the Conservatives were going to support gay marriage, it actually caused a lot of uproar among Conservative members. Now, UKIP basically thought, oh my god, we've got an opportunity, we can try and grab loads of ex-Tory members or this from Tory members, and they basically twisted their position on this issue to try and keep the libertarians aside them, but also grab in all those people who basically hated gay marriage and were so consumed by hatred for this policy. I think that really actually changed them from being a party of based on some ideals you talk about, Carl, to being a party of, you know, nothing but anger. I mean, their official policy was the biggest fudge ever, which was essentially, we're against gay marriage because the European Union court might say we have to do it in certain churches, and we're against the European Court of, you know, justice, and so we're against gay marriage. But then they allowed all those who are against gay marriage because they believe that gays should be burnt at the stake to say that and to promote that and say, join UKIP, we're against gay marriage. And what we're having now is almost like the comeback on all of that. So these people, you know, at the time, these people who said, well, you join our party because we're against gay marriage and we don't like gays, that's fine. And then now it's all sort of shooting back out again.
Yeah, absolutely. All I was going to chip in with was that at least, I mean, obviously this is politics that I find abhorrent, but at least the British National Party have tried to forge an idea that their politics is somehow grounded in a Christian nation. Let's not, you know, neglect to find the faults in that notion that they're a Christian party. But at that stage, on first principles, they can say, well, gay marriage is not for us because of our first principles. Not to mention the fact that Nick Griffin, the only get out for gay marriage for him was because he found gay men weird or something, what he said on Question Time that time. But what possible justification within the libertarian space is there to not like or not agree that gay marriage is moving forward in a country of progressive, particularly with social attitudes, progressive feelings? It's absurd.
Yeah, agreed. I mean, I think what I was going to say is that there's parallels here with the Tea Party in the US. By that I mean, if you look at when the Tea Party started, it was really about fiscal conservatism at the expense of anything else. So basically it was the idea that somehow the Republican Party had drifted away from that, and they brought up things like George W. Bush running up huge deficits and all this sort of stuff. And, you know, the core principle of the Republican Party needed to be about fiscal conservatism, a very libertarian sort of thrust to it. You know, you had people like Ron Paul, et cetera, involved. And then somehow over time it evolved from that to almost the opposite, to basically where they are now, which is basically just conservatism but nuttier. Like, you know, just push it to sort of where conservatism is in the U.S., just way further. You know, almost like pushing the Republicans to the right on absolutely everything, which is a sort of weird space. And I think that UKIP sort of, in a way, done the same thing. You know, in essence, they've sort of seen that libertarianism has a space, but maybe it's a limited one, whereas the anti-immigrant thing is a populist thing that it could be bigger, and they've sort of gone, they've just gone for that, in essence.
Yeah. The mood music for the Tea Party was Ayn Rand, and there was, loath as I am to say, there was a sort of space in the Tea Party for a kind of justification, an intellectual justification for what they were doing. And the suggestion that libertarianism equaled a kind of race, a kind of Darwinian race, for the survival of the fittest, and there was all these notions played up, and that included more literal terms of race, of dominance, and there was elements of that. The thing is with UKIP is because they're trying to be something to everyone in the run-up of the elections, but previous to that, I can't see their music going anywhere beyond Jim Davidson or Jeremy Clarkson. And it's let alone something like Ayn Rand. I would be surprised if many people in the top brass of UKIP, Nigel Farage included, know anything about Ayn Rand.
I just want to move the conversation on a little bit, but still related. So, obviously, I mean, over the last couple of weeks as a Conservative, we've been all very happy that, you know, we've been ahead of Labour in the polls, but if you look at it, we've been getting about 33%. Labour got 32%, and Lib Dems and UKIP were down in the low tens. I mean, what is the future for political parties when, you know, the big political parties can't even get a third of the electorate to support them? Nick, I'll let you go first with that.
Well, I think we're seeing a fraying of the political scene. I mean, it'll be interesting to see if the Greens can build on anything. If the debates go the 5-3-2 way and the Greens get anything out of that, possibly at Labour's expense. I mean, you know, you've got an electoral system that's not built really for five-party politics. And so you'll end up just getting a lot of very freakish sort of results. Can the big parties pull it back together? I don't know. It's very difficult. It's very, very difficult because, you know, the Conservatives and Labour were big tents for a long time, and that worked for a very, very long time. But I think, you know, with the rise of single party, single issue politics, etc., it's just going to become harder and harder for that to happen, for that to be the case. So I think that we'll just see a continuing fraying of the system. How that exactly will go, that's the difficult thing to predict.
Well, I mean, Carl, I mean, obviously, one of Ed Miliband's phrases that he repeats often is one nation, something or other, hardworking families, I don't know. He definitely tries to put a lot of one nation stuff in there, but the Labour Party vote is not a one nation vote. The Tory Party vote is not a one nation vote. There is actually, the one nation vote is actually seems to be against politics in general.
I remember that there was a speech that Ed Miliband was good, in fact, but the media portrayed this as something that was slightly, the record had stopped, and he'd said the words One Nation about 40 times or something. The One Nation for me is something that was both electorally appealing in the sense that there is more to politics than just ideological posturing. It was about trying to bring people together. And that's been missing in politics for a long time. I think that was Ed Miliband's attempt at trying to correct that. I get the point that this is a very difficult thing because every politician is having to tread carefully. And I take Nick's point about the rise of fringe parties and the single issue parties who are trying to dominate the message and doing so well, especially when trying to tap into the concerns of voters of the day, and if that includes Europe, so be it. If that includes the way in which individual councils are run, like the Greens have been able to do, and that's another thing. I don't really know what the end result of that is going to be. Certainly, it looks to me as if it's going to be something like a general alienation. But what's astounding to me is that David Axelrod, who Ed Miliband has very ingeniously taken on as his political mood music of the time, has talked about this, has talked about the next lot of elections as being predicated on a general sense of alienation. So I think that it's good that the Labour Party are going to be addressing this idea, and I think they've been doing this for some time, and I'm sure that John Cruddas and the Policy Review team have been looking into this somewhat. I know that he's a big fan of Raymond Williams, and Raymond Williams is someone interested.
But Carl, I mean that all sounds great, but when you see the infamous broadcasts where they took the piss out of Clegg and didn't say anything else about what they were going to do, I mean that was a nasty piece of politics. That's not what you've just been talking about.
Broadcast, if not to evoke humour and wit and a sense of emotion,
I didn't realise you're on the payroll, Carl. I mean, I know you're a Labour supporter, but, surely a party political broadcast should basically give people hope and say, this is why you should vote for me.
They did. They you're putting me in a position. I don't need to support the Labour Party as a Labour supporter. I was the only, I'm sure, I had a look on Twitter as soon as the election broadcast was broadcast, and I found myself supporting it, one of the only people supporting it, on the grounds that I thought it was really funny. I thought...
you're obviously a big fan of Harry Enfield.
Absolutely. I'm looking forward to the Fast Show reunion as well. But yes, I thought it was good wit. You know, that's what people want to listen to. Otherwise, people will turn off. I mean, I know he's on the payroll, but Danny Alec, I can't remember the name of him. But he went on. He was going on telly to talk about the part of the election broadcast and saying, This is why people turn off. People turn off their telly when they see this is the party political broadcast for whichever party. I think there was a corrective to that.
As an advisor, I'm not an advisor to the Tory party, but if I would, I would just say, well, your next party political broadcast should be cats doing cute things, because that will definitely stop people turning off the television. So
what an idea. I think great. I'd watch it.
But I mean, I think one of the problems with the political party structure is it just essentially nowadays we're very used to basically decisions becoming more personal, and we're very used to, as a society, is making more choices. But those who run political parties tend to do it in a secretive and very sort of top-down way, and you know those two things clash. And that while those two things clash, people are going to not join political parties. People are going to go away from political parties. And the problem I find is that people dislike how politics is done, but they're not interested enough to change it. While those who are in politics don't like the fact people are moving away, but still can get power even on smaller percentages. So there's no motivation to change. But at some point, the pressures must mean that something will change. I mean, Nick, do you think I'm being overly pessimistic?
I think there's cause for alarm. I mean, I think the disconnect is very real, and has repercussions, as we've seen with the rise of, well, first we saw that with the rise of the BNP and latterly the rise of UKIP. You know, populist parties who have very negative messaging will continue to do well if people feel disenfranchised from greater politics. I mean, how you change that is very difficult because, you know, it's all very well to say, oh, politicians should be a bit more real and they should talk about, you know, they should talk about things from the gut more and they should ignore the 24-hour news cycle. But, you know, as soon as anyone does, even for a moment, they are completely chastised, they are, you know, they are lambasted, and the public tend to eat it up. So, you know, the message from the public outwardly is, oh, well, we want politicians to be X, but actually every time politicians try to go in that direction, generally speaking, it doesn't work. So,
yeah.
So what's the solution to that? I don't know.
That's tough. That's. I mean, before we end, actually, I just want to bring up one point that I thought about earlier, but I didn't actually go there. But, Carl, do you think there's a room on the left for a UKIP-type party? And by UKIP-type party, I don't mean necessarily copying those type of policies, but essentially a small group that becomes a political party that can then drag the main political party to a place where they think they should be.
There was, and there is. There's a party called NoToEU. Sadly, it was headed up by Bob Crowe, who died.
But they're nowhere near as influential as UKIP are on conservatism. I mean, UKIP are probably not going to win an MP in 2015, probably not going to get any power necessarily, but their influence on the Conservative Party and the Conservative movement has been absolutely humongous.
UKIP are always very interesting for the press, and this has only been exacerbated by the fact that they've taken on Patrick O'Flynn from the Daily Express to organise what I think is, and I say this as someone who loathes UKIP, but who has taken on an ingenious campaign to try and get UKIP constantly in the press, and he's done so very, very well. I think that their influence on politics today is wildly, wildly exaggerated. What's going to happen is that they will do quite well in the European elections, but that's because they blow the dog whistle on European politics. What's so terribly, terribly frustrating for me is someone who is very influenced by the likes of Tony Benn, for example, and Gates got Michael Foot on the question of Europe, i.e. a question in the democratic deficit in the European Union, what's depressing is that the UKIP have been able to contain within their message both dog whistle political messaging about European Union, i.e. all those foreigners are going to come over here, but also part of of what I would call a left-wing Eurosceptic message, which is the idea that the European Council is run by a small clique of people and there's a huge democratic deficit that often results in it being very much a breeding ground for capital and capitalism and not very much in it for working people. And that is highlighted within the voting system, but also with regards to the way in which trade is managed in those participating countries. What's so frustrating for me is UKIP has managed to take on both of those messages. If there was a UKIP of the left, and I know that was something Owen Jones wrote in an article once upon a time, is there room for a UKIP of the left? If that was something that could take prominence in UK politics, then almost certainly we would have greater scope for showing UKIP for what it is, which is an opportunistic band of confused nutjobs.
Fair enough. Okay, all right. Well, just before we go, because that's all been really good, I'm just going to ask you both one question, which is slightly unfair. But if, Nick, I'll start with you. If somebody came up to you, a 24-year-old or whatever, said, I'm not going to bother voting, I can't be bothered, what would you say to them?
I would say, well, do you like the way the country is run at the moment? And if they said yes, I would say, well, the only way you can keep it going that way is by... Hello,
sorry, yeah, no, I think Carl dropped... Carl, are you back?
Okay. And the only way they can keep it... you can keep it going is by voting to keep the government. The only way, if they say no, then the only way you can do it is by voting against someone other than the government. Otherwise, you have no right to complain. So I would just say, if you want to keep your mouth shut for the next 5 years, fine. I'd probably say that you don't. So I would say, figure out someone who most represents your views and go for it, because at least you've done it. You've done all you can. And I think that's all you can do. And if everyone does the same as you, then there will be a difference made.
If a young person came up to you and said, I'm not going to bother voting, what would you say to them?
I would say that it may seem like all of the parties are speaking from the same book. It may seem like that because of the broad, the amount of people they're trying to speak to, the amount of people they're trying to get on board. But the differences between the parties are so much, and it matters today so much because we have, unfortunately, people who want to create social community discohesion. I'd probably try and find the word for that properly. But there are people who want to ruin our communities. There are people who want to try and tell you that the fault of the world's economy and this economy is to do with those people next door, those people, and there's definitely a racial element to that. But it's not true. It's not true. We want to be making decisions. This is our right to do so, and we get that right. And other countries don't. We should. We have that right. We should hold those people to the example that we would want them to, the standard that we would want them to have. That's why we should vote today. That's why. Because we have that right. We get to decide. That's what I want to. That's what I want to show them.
Cool. That's how you convinced me. I'm going to go and vote next Thursday.
Good.
I would have done it anyway because I'm actually on the ballot paper next Thursday where I live. So, which I think that's a way to encourage people. Everyone should be on the ballot paper. Mind you, that might make for very long ballot papers.
That's enormous.
Anyway, all right. Well, thanks to both my guests for joining me today for what's been a really interesting discussion. Next week, me and one of my co-hosts, Emma, and we'll be doing a show. We'll be joined by a Lib Dem to discuss the EU election results and the local election results. So I hope you can join us then. Thanks for listening. Bye.